Hello and welcome to episode 397 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous by sharing news or asking questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. We're actually going to lead today with an item that listeners sent in to us, brand new news from LSAC that came out tomorrow, or came out yesterday, about them doing offline testing again. So they're going to have testing centers. We'll get into it in just a second. That's the big news for today. This show is going to air on Monday, April 10th. That means you have a week still before Ben's free reading comprehension class. That's coming up on Monday, April 17th, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Go to lsat.link/Ben if you'd like to register for that. Go to lsatdemon.com/classes if you want to register for any of our free stuff. All right, ready to get into this brand new news?
Let's do it.
Cool. What do you think? I mean, were you shocked when you saw this, or were you like, oh?
I was a little surprised just because it's so much more convenient, I think, to proctor an online test than to proctor an online test in person testing centers, right? So they're like going back to what they did before, but not entirely, because the test is still going to be administered digitally. And
I would think that the vast majority of applicants are still going to, or candidates are still going to choose the home version. I mean, scores have skyrocketed since COVID, right? Or boy, at least scores for our students have skyrocketed since COVID. That could be because people are prepping more efficiently, prepping at home instead of commuting to a live class and sitting there for 15 minutes waiting for the class to start. You know, now people are just prepping online and it makes sense to do it that way. Anyway, starting with August 2023, you're going to have the choice of whether to take the test in its current online live remote proctored format or in person at a digital testing center. I believe they said that they're using Prometric, which I hadn't heard of before. Had you heard of Prometric, Ben?
No, I didn't even see that. Was that after you click on this link, I guess?
Yeah, Ben is so interested in this news that he didn't even click on the link in the email from LSAC. Yeah, it's just another one of these things that it's like big news, but not for most people. If you have an LSAC account, you probably already got this email. If you don't have an LSAC account, you need an LSAC account anyway. So go to lsac.org and register so that you can start getting these emails. Yeah, you're going to have a choice. So these testing centers, I think, Ben, it's the thing that we've been requesting for years before the LSAT even went online, before it ever even went to the tablet thing that they had for a while. We were like, why are you guys administering these tests yourself? Why don't you just administer them through local testing centers, which is what the GMAT does, and I think it's what the GRE does, and it's what the NCLEX and a bunch of other tests do. Series 7, if you're a stockbroker. I mean, there's like all these tests, that licensing tests that you can take at a, they call them learning centers or testing centers or whatever. But basically, it's just you go into a strip mall and there's like a person there at the counter and they check you in and you go to an anonymous computer terminal. And when you are authenticated or whatever, then it just, the test pops up on the screen. And when I took my GMAT, I got my score back instantly because they, and this was 20 years ago, I got my score back instantly for the GMAT because I had taken it at one of these testing centers. And we've always been wondering why the LSAC doesn't just do that. It's probably to do with one of two things. It's either money or security, right? They're either worried that the test is going to be easier to steal or something if they let other people get involved, or they just have to, probably the reality is they have to pay money to these testing centers to let people do this. But this looks really promising. I saw one little interesting detail of it, which was you can register for an in-person test at one of these testing centers. Note, you'll probably be the only person taking the LSAT that day at that testing center. It'll, you know, you just schedule it at your own, whatever time you want to take it at, and go in and take it. And there could be somebody on your right taking the NCLEX and someone on your left taking the GMAT, and you're just there to take the LSAT. No big deal. up to, it said, up to 3 days before your official test, you can actually switch back to the I'll take it at home option. I found that to be kind of interesting. I was trying to think about what the motivations would be for that. Again, I think it's probably to do with money, right? Like they don't, if you decide you want to take it at home instead, then they, it saves them whatever.
That must be the termination time for that testing right. center, right? They have some deal where if you cancel 3 days before, they're not going to charge LSAC the money to have someone come take it at their testing center. I would say that they said that they were responding to feedback. So some people are asking for this. I'm not totally surprised. People probably in some cases have noisy homes or they just don't have a great place where they can sit down and take the test and they want some place to go. And, you know, LSAC was paying for people to go stay in a hotel room. That was
I imagine that's the bigger issue because we heard of people who were actually going to a hotel room for 2 nights because the test was scheduled at, you know,
in the morning. Yeah.
Yeah. The test is
In the afternoon. Yeah, that's right.
If the test is at, you know, if it's going to run you over the checkout time or if it's before the check-in time, you know, anytime that's like really in the middle of the day. It's hard to have a business meeting in a hotel if you're only there for one night. So that's a lot of expense. The other thing that they were doing was sending out loaner computers to people.
Yeah.
Right. So this idea
solves both of those problems.
Right.
And they said it's at great expense to themselves, which was an interesting comment to make. But really? Maybe it's actually saving them money.
You got to think that they're preparing to raise the price of the LSAT again. You know, they're constantly saying what all of their expenses are. And yeah, whatever. This seems like a good thing to me. It's an option for
it's increasing options. Yeah,
right. I don't see how this is bad. Of course, talk to me in a few months and I might have ideas about how it turned out to be bad. But hopefully this goes smoothly. And yeah, because you're right. I mean, some people, you know, if you have 9 roommates or 4 kids or noisy neighbors or whatever it is, then it can be really difficult to try to take the test in a home environment. Maybe you have sketchy Wi-Fi. Maybe it's impossible for you to get good Wi-Fi, whatever. There's lots of reasons.
Or you need a device. I mean, this solves a bunch of problems all at once.
Right.
You said that you would go take it and there probably wouldn't be other people taking the LSAT that day with you in the testing center. That's probably true. Although I did find it odd. Well, not odd, I guess just restrictive in the sense that they are limiting when you can take it to the typical 2 or 3 days that they're allowing.
That has to be cheating related, right?
Yeah, that's related, which is weird because you still have that 2 to 3 day window, right? So it's very easy to talk to somebody who's already taking it, presumably at the beginning of that window, but whatever. They're
unlike
trying to
the GMAT.
Yeah.
And unlike the SAT now is moving in this direction. You know, they haven't gone to any kind of a computer adaptive test. They don't have a huge test bank that they can then pull different questions for different students. They've never gone that route. Everybody takes the same test on the same day. And so if they spread it out over a week or two, then, you know, unfortunately, you're going to have piracy happening or just cheating.
It makes it easier, right?
I'll take the test on Monday and then I'll tell you guys what was on it and you guys can take the test on Thursday.
Yep.
And that's what they're trying to avoid by making everybody take it on the same day. I still think that the vast majority of people are going to take it at home. I don't think that this Prometric option is going to, because I mean, it's just what it's a hassle. Why really? You want to go somewhere instead of just taking it in your bedroom? So I think most people are going to want to take it in a quiet spot at home. But yeah, I guess it could be. I could be totally wrong about that. It could be that these testing centers completely fill up. I think that that's if you do want to take it at one of these testing centers, maybe there is now some motivation again to sign up early so that you can get the slot of your choosing.
Yeah, I don't know that they would fill up necessarily. I just think because they have this narrow window, right? There's a decent chance if you show up at one, you're probably going to see a couple other people like, oh, yeah, you're taking the LSAT. Got it. You know, who knows?
Could be.
But
yeah.
Yeah.
We will see. And we can't wait to hear news. So, you know, if you've got thoughts about this, please get back to us on our website, thinkinglsat.com. We got a form there you can fill out and you can share whatever news or ask whatever questions you want. This is interesting. So we want to know what you guys think about it.
Yeah, here's my last speculation on it. If I were them, I would do this to test out what it's like to work with one of these digital testing centers and have it be the first step in a transition to a computer adaptive test, right? Like, it's like, okay, let's start here, very small step, see how it works. If they like it, the costs work out as they expect. Hey, it opens up the door to eventually copying the GMAT and being competitive in that way, right?
And outsourcing your whole thing to some other company and just letting, you know, letting one of these, there are companies, Ben, that exist in the world that they do nothing but administer tests.
Yes, they have security for this. And figured it out. Yeah.
LSAC is obviously really, really concerned about test security. Another thing that I noticed in their announcement, or maybe it was just somewhere on their website as I was poking around yesterday, I noticed that they are no longer going to be offering pencil and paper anywhere outside of the US and Canada, which I thought was interesting. And my immediately,
too much security, right?
Immediately my mind went to security. It's like, well, yeah, we can't be doing this in China, because if we do this in China, it's going straight to the copy machine, the scanner, and it's going straight online. And, you know, although it's not like it's impossible to do that in the United States, I just, but what,
maybe
why
they
else
feel
would,
like they have legal
could be that,
you know, control
absolutely
here, yep, more than they have in other
at least
countries.
We can sue, at least we know we'll be able to sue somebody if they do it in the United States, but if they, yeah, do it in China, we got really no recourse. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's enough of our speculations. We do, yep, not know what we're talking about. We're just announcing the news, and 95% of what we said was just speculation there.
Yeah.
No changes until the August 2023 LSAT.
Okay.
So a few months until this actually rolls out in the real world. We've got an email that came in here from Anonymous. It's about a new daemon feature that I don't actually know that much about, so maybe you can answer this one, but go ahead and read it.
Sure. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I've been using the daemon for quite some time now, and I have a ton of items accumulated in my review inbox. How do you suggest we use the review inbox and incorporate the review of that in our 1 hour a day schedule? I've compiled so much that it is overwhelming to go through them all. And there are also items in there that I may have already reviewed when going back and reviewing a time section. How exactly does review inbox work? Is it important to review these items? What further steps should we take to review these, if any? For example, practice that same question type or section. Thanks for your help. I wanted to ask this to one of you in class, but no longer have the live subscription. All right. Please give Chris Murphy a raise. Incredible teacher. Yeah, Chris is amazing. I hope Chris hears that. Anyways, there are some things we need to do to improve review inbox, but the thing I'm going to tell Anonymous right now is there is an option, and this was designed on purpose, for you to clear everything out of your inbox with
you could say fell swoop, but you also could just
fell
say click.
Swoop. Yeah. One click. Yeah, that would be better. Okay. Anyways, and since I'm struggling to say that, I probably should say one click. But anyways, in the top right corner, you can just clear them all out. And that's because the point of this is not to overwhelm you with things to review. The point of this really was, and this is what we need to continue tweaking to get it just right, but when someone does a timed logical reasoning section, right, and they're done with it, they may have five questions that they missed that they should review, and they review three of them before they have to take off. The idea here is just to list out the individual questions, because I don't want someone to be overwhelmed by, oh, I got to review that section. No, just take the first one on the list, review that one, take the second one on the list, review that one. Now you're done with the section. This is even more potentially helpful in a timed test situation where people finish the test and now they feel like they have to review the whole test. It's like a one checklist item. And it's like, no, you just have to review one of the questions you got wrong on that test. And even then, review inbox isn't giving you all the questions you got wrong. It's only giving you the questions you got wrong and attempted. So,
okay,
the idea is to guide people towards questions they attempted, actually tried during the time section, and missed.
So this user, Anonymous, has made the mistake of not looking at the review box often enough. It strikes me that you might be able to just completely ignore the review inbox if you were already reviewing
Absolutely.
In another way. When you're drilling, you should be doing one question at a time, and we really do want you to do your review right there. We don't want you to drill a question, miss it, and then just like click through everything next. Like, that's not it, because we want you to learn as much as you can from that question right there. But if you do a time section or if you do a time test, then what Review Inbox will do is it'll show you only the mistakes on questions you actually spent time on. And that's the purpose of it. And you should never let that build up to an overwhelming list. We should really be striving for Review Inbox zero. And what that means is, you know, you want to get your review inbox down to zero every day if you can. And the way to do that is probably to just start over with the one fell swoop button and clear it all out. It's like archive all. Just get out of there. OK, fine. Yep. I fucked up. I admit it. I mean, just get rid of all those. And then now I'm going to, you know, every time I look at my review inbox, I'm going to review them all the way down to zero. And that's the way people should be using it.
Yes. And it doesn't accumulate for drilling because, like you said, we're assuming that you're doing the one question and then immediately reviewing it. That's not where the problem arises. The problem arises most commonly when someone does a full test and then they just let it's like too overwhelming.
And then they do another section and then they do another section. And now the review inbox starts building up and they haven't gone in and cleared that out. Ben and I are both, if you're not already familiar with the concept of inbox zero, Ben and I are both devotees of the inbox zero method of managing your email. It means use Gmail because Gmail is the best, but use Gmail and then you archive emails rather than trying to save them or categorize them or flag them or folder them or whatever. Yeah. Instead, you just archive them. And the idea is you're going to look at when you look at your email, you're going to act on the email. So you can put stuff onto your calendar if you want. You can put stuff onto your to-do list if you want, but you don't let it just fester in your inbox. Inbox is for new mail only. And we want to process that down to zero. So you want to be processing your review inbox down to zero as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to say about inbox zero. I just want to add a couple more things. One, you're not constantly checking your email, right? You're deliberately... Right. I'm going to go in, I'm going to check it maybe once a day, maybe it's twice a day, maybe it's even three times a day. But when you go in, you're going in and you're going to look at an email and do something about it. None of this, interesting, so-and-so wrote me, oh, I should get back to that later. It's like, no, either delete it, archive it, or act on it. And part of that acting may just be taking that email and boiling it down to a to-do item and then putting that on your to-do list. So then it gets sorted in a thoughtful way, not, oh, there it is again. That's so inefficient and just dumb, really.
Something you just said something interesting. Did you say delete it, comma, archive it? Or, okay, I don't delete anything. I only archive.
I delete like garbage. Yeah. That I never want to see in my search results when I'm searching for past email.
The reason why I don't do that, the reason why I don't have delete and archive is that I just don't want to have to make that decision. It's faster for me to process through my email if I don't have to decide. So it's for me, it's just, am I acting on this right now? Okay, I'm going to act on it and I'm going to archive it. If it's, am I acting on this right now? Am I acting on it ever? Okay, archive it. And so then just everything goes into the archive, and I even have the settings on my phone changed so that when I swipe or whatever, it's just archive, archive. Everything goes into archive. Yep. So I have a whole, you know, and then all my inbox, all my emails forever are just infinitely searchable through Google. I've been doing that now for 10 years. Never had a problem with it. Anybody that I've ever been able to convert over to inbox zero is like, can't believe they ever did it in any different way. Just Google inbox zero if you want to learn more about this. But if email is a hassle to you, if email is overwhelming to you, you might be able to make yourself a more efficient person by learning how to do inbox zero properly.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, the reason I love it the most is that it opens up opportunities that I would otherwise miss in a flooded inbox, right? Yeah. Like when I'm at inbox zero at some point during the day, it just happens. For me, it has to happen once every 24 hours. Sometimes it happens twice. But when things do come in that are important and of high priority, I see them and then I can act on them. And again, as soon as I'm acting on them, then I'm archiving them. So if anything else pops up, but it's not this thing, you know, because people can misinterpret it. They're like, oh, inbox zero. This is like someone hovering over their inbox and you're not a slave to your inbox. You go in, you bring it down to zero, and then you get out. And that's right.
Yeah, no more just leaving your email open on your desktop all day. And checking your inbox is like checking your mailbox. You're going to check that to see what new stuff came in. And yeah, you might, unlike your mailbox, you might go back to your inbox a couple, three times a day, maybe more if you're in an office environment, 9 to 5, and you really do need to be responsive to emails in a timely manner. You might go in more often. But for most people, for me and for you, Ben, we have found no reason to be checking our email 100 times a day.
No.
In fact, well, there's lots of reasons not to do that.
It's very unproductive. And then it becomes your taskmaster. And I do have very deliberate distinctions between acting now on an email and then saying, no, I am going to do something, but I'm putting it into my list. And then that's being sorted amongst other things as the priority dictates, so that my email is not, again, my manager.
Yeah, it's right? Here. Like, I have to take care of it. I have to do this thing that takes 30 minutes right now. No. You put it on your list and prioritize it. And
yep.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Let's keep it moving. We've got an email here from Bella. Bella's subject is thank you. She says, I went from a 134 taking the LSAT blindly like a nut, thinking it would be like any test out of college. Other prep companies drained me mentally, financially, and emotionally for 2 years. I was always a straight A student, so finding something that I couldn't conquer was a tough pill to swallow. I was memorizing all the tricks or terms they directed me to no avail. I found your podcast totally by accident and almost gave up on law school when you mentioned something about scoring so low. So I tried again, third and last time with the demon. About 5 months in, my scores fluctuate between 163 and 171. Holy the God. Demon made me realize I was not the problem. It was the tutoring companies. You made learning fun for me again and changed the way I understood what the test was actually testing, understanding, or as Nathan says, calling out the BS. I'm taking the April LSAT and I've postponed law school per your advice. I will be applying first thing come September. Thank you both for making this awesome program, Bella. One thing I want to say to Bella is that there's no reason why this is your third and final time, Bella. You're allowed to take the test 3 times in one testing cycle, but 5 times in 5 years. And the testing cycle restarts with the August LSAT. So if you're taking it for a third time in April, that might be your third time in this cycle. But come August, you're going to have another bite at the apple. So I would prefer that you don't consider this April test to be your last ever test. Instead, I think you need to be thinking about it as, well, I do have, more appeals that I could make in August and September if I need to. And, you know, if you take April and you only score 160 or 162, I do think you'd be crazy not to take it again because you have practice test scores that indicate that you can do much better. So I would really fire all of those bullets if necessary. Thanks for taking our advice, by the way, Bella.
Yeah.
I think good things are going to happen if you continue to do that.
As you were reading this, I was thinking about class on Monday. We did, I don't know if you remember the highly successful salesperson's question.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's a formulaic passage. And so a lot of people reflexively immediately start diagramming that question. And that's the question that most people wanted to talk about when we were done doing questions in class. And I just started talking about it and talking about, hey, there's two groups of people. We have the highly successful people and we have the people who aren't highly successful over here. And, you know, this is what I know about these people. And this is what I know about those people. And okay, do we understand these people? And it's like, yeah, now let's go answer the questions. And we're just knocking them out. No diagramming. And when I'm done explaining the answers, I'm like, hey, so which questions were people, or which answer choices were people confused by? Because this was the most requested question for us to review. And people were like, well, it makes sense now. And I said, okay, well, what was the frustration? Were people diagramming? And everybody's, a lot of people were like, yeah, like I was diagramming and I just got all tied up in knots. And I think that's what partly Bella is referring to here, right? The test, this isn't rocket science. It's just two groups of people. And they told us some things about these two groups of people. And now everything just kind of makes sense. And you don't need to, you know, create arrows going from one left to the right. And
one question at a time, one sentence at a time, one word at a time. And you need to be focusing on understanding it. I don't think that diagramming it on logical reasoning is going to help you. I think that if you could just read it more carefully, I think you would understand it. And I do see students all the time confusing themselves by using these highly technical methods to answering questions that, you know, more than half the time boil down to common sense. If you just kind of read it carefully and think it through.
Just think about it. Just think, okay, here's some people, here's some other people. What do I know about them? It's that simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Why don't you read this email from Ali?
The subject is, should I keep on going? I graduated in May of 2022 and I have been studying for the LSAT since September. I started at a 143 and I'm now scoring at a 161. I've been scoring in this range since February. I've been able to master games, never missing a question. I usually get 6 wrong in logical reasoning and 10 wrong in reading comprehension. I would like to get into the 170s. I have a 3.82 GPA, and I think I could get into some good schools / full rides with a higher score. But I just do not know if my time improving is over. I have used the demon for almost my entire study journey, and I appreciate it. ! Please let me know if you think I should take the LSAT or if I should keep on trying.
Well, let's see. You've improved by 18 points since September. You've been at it for a while. You have already perfected the games, which is great. That's the one, you know, if you had not perfected the games, I would for sure say keep studying. Because you got to get to the point where you're perfect on the games if you think you're going to get into the 170s. You are not performing on logical reasoning and reading comprehension in the way that 170 scorers perform. Without knowing what kinds of questions you're missing on LR, I can't really give you, and I don't mean question types, I mean specific questions. I'd have to look at your actual individual mistakes and reason through them with you. We do that in live classes all the time. So, you know, I would just love to have you in my double black diamond class, for example, where you had maybe suggested a logical reasoning question for the agenda, and we could be going through your actual mistakes in that class. I think I could help you in LR there. Missing 10 on reading comp is a pretty big barrier to getting to the 170s, huh?
Yeah. I mean,
that's the big deal here.
I'm looking at these numbers and you have a 3.82 GPA. I have no idea what you studied, but you have 0 wrong in the games. Logical reasoning in my mind is very similar to the games. It's just a word version.
It is.
I think you have the potential to keep going. I think you just need to start thinking about logical reasoning more like the games. And then once you improve that, start thinking about reading comprehension more like logical reasoning.
I'll give you one tip for reading comp. If you're finishing the section and getting minus 10, that's your problem, is that you're finishing the section. You need to be instead only doing 3 passages, because you should be able to do 3 passages and only get like minus 6 or minus 7, right? If you can do 3 perfect passages, you're already better than minus 10, because there's never 10 questions in a section or in a passage rather.
Yeah.
So, but if it is a speed issue, you know, like if you're struggling to finish the third passage, if your accuracy is high, but you're just not making it through the third passage. I don't know. That could be a pretty up, like a kind of an uphill battle. The way you're going to get faster is by being better at predicting the answers. The way you're going to get better at predicting the answers is by slowing down, reading more carefully, taking the time to think about it. You know, when they ask you a question on reading comp, you got to cover up those answer choices. You got to think about it. You know, they're asking you which one of the following, you know, the author is most likely to believe which one of the following or something based on the passage. And you need to think about it. Well, what did the author say in the passage about this topic? And you need to try to predict that answer. The reason why you do that is twofold. One, sometimes you're just going to straight predict the answer. Two, it's going to make the wrong answers look even worse. And that's how you're going to be able to go fast. We're never trying to go fast through the passage. We're never trying to go fast through the question, but we're going to blaze through wrong answer choices by predicting answers. And if you haven't already felt that particular click, then I would encourage you to keep practicing until you can get that click.
I totally agree. I do want to clarify that we are talking about a loose prediction. I do think people tend to get hung up on this idea of predicting the answer and thinking that, oh, I have to predict the answer that the LSAT is going to give me. And we're just sometimes, right, we're just talking about, does the author agree or disagree with this claim? Right. Yeah, the author seems to like this. Okay, I'm ready. Let me go into the answer choices.
Yeah, roughly thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah.
I mean, does the author like this or does the author dislike this?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's enough to narrow it down to just one answer.
Yeah, because three of them are going in the opposite direction. And you're like, okay, clearly wrong.
Yeah. I hope that was helpful, Allie. This next one is from Isadora. Isadora says, register because of accommodations? Question mark. Hi, Ben and Nathan. Y'all rock. I have a question about signing up for a test when applying for accommodations for the first time. My score isn't quite where I want it. After 4 months, I'm in the high 160s, but shooting for mid 170s. I'm content to study as long as it takes. Law school isn't going anywhere. However, I plan to apply for accommodations, not based on previous accommodations, so it's not a done deal. Ideally, I'd like to know whether I'll get approved or not so I can start studying with those in play. However, LSAC will only evaluate your accommodations application when it's for a specific test that you've already registered for. That is true. I know you advise not to register until you're hitting your goal score. However, I'm tempted to register for June so that I can apply for accommodations and just see if I'll get them. 50% extra time plus read aloud. Maybe push to August or beyond. Maybe take the test in June. Not sure yet. Any thoughts on this? I have thoughts, but I'll let you start, Ben.
Well, I don't hate the idea of signing up for a test, especially one that's further into the future.
Yeah, because you can always push or right. Like there's a, if you sign up well before the registration deadline, then you can just withdraw for a full refund.
Yeah. So if you, test date change, this is what I wanted to look up and confirm. So I'm on the LSAC, fees or the LSAC website, and it's LSAT and CAS fees. And it says you can change your test date through your test administration's registration deadline for no charge. So there you go. You know, you're going to take the test at some point. Sign up for the test, get approved for accommodations, or see whether or not you'll get approved for accommodations. And then if you're ready for the test by the registration deadline, great, take it. If you're not, move it forward to the next test for no charge.
You just got to make sure that you keep track of that registration deadline. You're already registered and you have this option to move it into the future for free up till that date. But that date is surprisingly early. It's like 6 weeks before the date of the actual test. And if you're even one day over that deadline, then the fees that kick in are pretty exorbitant. So you're going to want to make sure that you do, assess your situation 6-7 weeks in advance. And then if you're nowhere near where you want to be, then you can kick it down the road. I had never really thought about that before, Isadora. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. But I can see a reason for accommodated students to sign up early. just to see if they're going to get the accommodations.
And also, see what they're going to get, right? Yeah.
And yeah, and see exactly. Well, I mean, I was just going to say, my wager would be, Isadora, you're going to get everything you ask for. I mean, it's yeah. just, like, that seems to be what people get. So if you have any kind of a credible case, if you have any documentation whatsoever, a note from your doctor is going to be sufficient here. I think that you're going to get what you want. So 50% extra time and read aloud. That's not unusual at all. And I think that you will get those accommodations. But sure, yeah, go ahead and register for a test that's way out there, like August or June. Although, is June way out there at this point? The June registration deadline is April 25th. So you could register now and hope that they approve your accommodations promptly. But between now and, yeah, you only have till April 25th to decide to push that. So if they haven't yet given you your decision by April 25th, then you definitely want to push. And if they do give you your decision, then you have to decide, okay, am I going to be able to score what I want to score in June by April 25th? Otherwise, you should probably push it.
Yep. Great.
Next one from B.
Hi, Ben and Nate. I'm coming to the LSAT law school world as a non-traditional student.
Can we stop saying non-traditional student, do we think?
Sure.
Well, yeah. It's just so meaningless. It's a conclusion, right? It's a label. What do you mean you're a non-traditional student? That means different things to different people. And I think that, you know, like half the emails that we get claim to be from non-traditional students. So I don't know. I don't think there really is such a thing necessarily as a traditional student. And I also believe that we have seen some of the very best law schools in the world discriminating against the so-called traditional students. I mean, Harvard says explicitly that they prefer people with work experience.
Yeah.
So non-traditional student is also known as someone with work experience.
Yeah.
But yep. Anyway, go ahead.
I finished my undergrad 10 years ago in an online program. I couldn't tell you a single one of my professor's names, much less hope to muster a letter of recommendation worth a hill of beans from any of them. In the case where a professor isn't a reasonable option, I've heard the preferred route is to use a professional reference. My current employer would give a glowing recommendation if I were to ask, but I don't want to tip my hand with them by letting them know my plans to leave so long before law school would actually begin. I've loved my job and the relationships I've built there, and I haven't exhausted my growth opportunities with them. Working there has been mutually beneficial and positive. As soon as they know I don't plan to stay long term, the dynamic will change, even though they'll understand and be happy for me. It'd be like that moment when you've offered a heartfelt goodbye to a friend after chatting up. After catching up, then awkwardly walk in the same direction to your cars. Okay, interesting analogy. Instead, they can reasonably continue to provide for my family right up to the moment when their schedule interferes with classes. I still have time to consider, but I am at a loss to think of a good option for a letter of recommendation. Previous official employers have been part-time and temporary. I also babysat for 4 years, but I don't think that parent would be the right option to write a recommendation either. Thoughts? Thanks for your help with the demon and the podcast. When is this person applying? I just don't, like, just wait until you're closer to applying. I don't understand the need to get a letter now.
I guess if they're planning to apply this fall, we are getting to that point where you need to get your letters of recommendation in. By the way, you're going to need at least two letters of recommendation, not just one. So yeah. You're going to have to figure this out one way or the other. I don't believe you that you can't remember a single one of your professor's names. Surely if you looked back at your transcript, the professor's names are going to probably be there. And if not, you can call the registrar's office and they've got to keep a record of all that. Professors are used to writing letters of recommendation. If you had let's say you had a professor that you took twice and got an A in both classes, I feel like that's a professor that even if you don't remember them and they don't remember you, they still probably could be convinced to write you a, you know, it'll be pretty perfunctory, but it'll be fact-based. Like the professor will end up writing a letter that's like, the student got an A in both of my classes, that puts them in the top 5% of my students. You know, letters of recommendation in large part are just kind of ticking off boxes. They don't necessarily need to be glowing, but you do need to be able to find people that you trust and that trust you and that are going to vouch for you. And if you can't do that, it kind of like, you know, it indicates something to the law schools. I suppose you can get two from your same employer, right? Like you might be able to get one from your manager and one from a director above that you worked closely with or something.
Sure.
I don't know. My other advice is just to kind of get over it. Like, is it really that bad when you offer a heartfelt goodbye to a friend after catching up and then have to awkwardly walk in the same direction to the car?
I mean, that's kind of the direction I'm going in. You're gonna break up with this company at some point. In fact, if you do it now and you're like, well, this isn't for a year and a half, I'm not going to be going to law school for some time, they're still going to try to get, you know, as much out of you as they can. I think between now and then, they can just plan. I don't know.
Who knows what types of opportunities might open up? Remote work is now really, really a thing, right? And maybe there's some way that you can still work with this company 10 or 15 hours a week remotely, even while you're in law school. If they love you as much as you say they do, why wouldn't they be willing to consider some type of other working relationship?
Yeah.
It's your life. So like, is that really what you're worried about? Is like the awkwardness? Yeah, life is awkward. Sometimes you just have to get over it.
Yeah. I mean, are you worried about losing your job? That can be challenging, but as long as you can keep your job, you're going to keep getting money. And this is not your long-term plan, right? If you're planning to go to law school, then this is going to be in the rearview mirror in 2 years.
Yeah. Sorry if that's not satisfying or helpful, B, but yeah, it does sound to me like if you're applying this fall, then you definitely need to, maybe not this month, but you know, if you want to get your applications in by September 1st, I would think that something along the lines of June 1st might be the latest that I would be asking for this letter of recommendation. People have vacations, people have other priorities, you know, you're not going to get as good of a letter if you pop up saying, hey, I need a letter of recommendation for law school. I'm applying tomorrow. Now, that is not going to result in something good for you. I mean, at the best, it'll be probably a delay of your application.
Yeah.
And at worst, it'll be a letter that is tepid or potentially even bad if you spring it on them at the last minute.
Yeah, it's going to make things more awkward. So either decide to get a letter and get it as soon as possible, or decide to get it from your professors and avoid this problem at work. But I don't know if it's as big of a problem as you're making it.
You can work on the professors simultaneously, by the way. You don't have to decide in advance which letters you're actually going to use. You can accumulate letters in your LSAC account. So I would work on a professor or two and see if anything comes back. You might be surprised that, you know, they're willing to do this. And if not, you know, the only thing you've really lost is your time. You could also at the same time think about how you're going to communicate this to your job, right? I mean, we need to learn how to communicate in honest, direct, thoughtful ways. And if you have as good of a relationship as you say you do with your employer, then surely there is a way that you can communicate this to them honestly without ruining your entire working dynamic.
It also shows respect to them, right? So,
yeah. And if they don't show respect back to you, then fuck them. It wasn't what you thought it was anyway. You know, like it seemed better than it really was if they don't take this well. If you communicate this to them in a thoughtful, kind, professional way, then I don't see why it has to negatively change the dynamic. I think it could change it for the positive.
Yep.
Maybe they're going to start trying to throw more money at you to keep you if you're really that valuable to them.
Yeah.
You'll never know until you open that door. Next one is from Nikki. Subject is law school decision. Hi, Ben and Nathan. My name is Nikki and I'm a prospective law student for this fall. I used LSAT Daemon when studying for the LSAT last summer, and I applied to law school in November of 2022. I received most of my admittances and I'm having trouble deciding where to go to law school. Here are my options. UC Hastings' $20,000 offer would have to pay $24,000 more plus housing. Okay, I would never in a million years accept that offer. I'm a Hastings grad. I do not think it's worth it to pay more than half price for a school like Hastings. If you were going to do that, I don't see why you wouldn't just take a full ride to Golden Gate or USF, which are right there in San Francisco. And if you're on a full ride at USF or Golden Gate, you're going to have all the same opportunities that you would have if you're paying tuition at Hastings. Like, if let's be honest, if you're paying tuition at Hastings, you're probably going to have a tough time in the academic competition. There's some real smart fuckers at Hastings. And okay, I would decline that option.
So one less option. Next.
Well, or I would use it to negotiate with the likes of USF, Golden Gate.
I mean, to be clear, I agree with you. Hastings for money doesn't sound good. What's
it's
the next
a mediocre
one?
Law school, right? It's an okay law school with pretensions and like surface level appearances of being a national law school. They act and look a hell of a lot more prestigious than they actually are.
It's interesting that Nikki is calling it UC Hastings since it's made such a big deal about changing its name, but
UC Law San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the second best law school that you can see from the campus of UC Hastings, because you can go into the tower at UC Hastings and look across the bay and see Berkeley. So it's just if there's a better law school within visual distance of a school, then it's probably not that great of a school. You know, it's like BU Law School looking across the Charles River at Harvard. Mm-hmm. You know that BU is not the shit because that's Harvard right there. You know that Hastings is not the shit because that's Berkeley right there. And I know you think that that's a great school. It's not. Okay. Chapman full tuition plus $10,000 every year. Okay. So, wow. Oh, so that's an over full ride and a stipend at Chapman.
Fuck.
Vastly
yeah, I
better.
Mean, you're
vastly
getting
safer
money.
Option. Yeah. Now, jeez. Chapman is a sketchy law school. But
yeah.
Hastings is also a sketchy law school for the people who pay tuition to go to Hastings. That's the thing that people don't understand. Hastings is a great law school for people who are there on a full ride. Because you know you're going to get the best of what Hastings has to offer. But if you're paying tuition, if you're paying, you know, they've got, like, it's obvious. The school is way overpriced. They're going to throw you this bullshit $20,000 offer and you're still going to have to pay $24,000. It's a school that is going to cost you $24,000. And it's not worth $24,000. So you don't take that offer. It's just that would be very risky to make that decision.
Hey, I just looked at the 509 report for Chapman, and I will say that it has conditional scholarships. And in 2021 to 2022, 112 students entered with scholarships, and 45 of those were reduced or eliminated.
Yeah. So you got to be careful. I mean, but the thing to do there, though, Ben, and people hate this advice, but this is, I believe this 1,000%. Go to Chapman, work your ass off, keep your scholarship. If you lose your scholarship, drop out of law school.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd much rather prefer it. You have a chance at getting $10,000 a year on top of your tuition versus a guarantee of paying $24,000. At Hastings.
Yeah, you're going to graduate from Hastings with over $100,000 in debt and very uncertain job outcomes. You could graduate from Chapman with very little debt and uncertain outcomes. I mean, you're going to have uncertain outcomes at all these schools. None of these schools are going to be a golden ticket. But yeah. What's the opposite of a golden ticket? Fucking lead anchor ticket. You know, like
which
to get to the bottom of the
debt.
Ocean.
Yeah,
which is what you're going to be so underwater if you go to Hastings. And if you go to Chapman and keep your scholarship, then you're probably doing well. If you go to Chapman and you can't keep your scholarship, you're not. This is not going to be it, like the outcomes are not going to be good for you anyway. And you should just drop out and do something else.
Yeah.
Anyway, hey, there's some other options. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
But I just, I know I talked about this on the last episode, but because I'm so into the undergrad college evaluation mindset right now, with one kid already in school and another one about to go to school, we constantly talk about the cost of attendance, which is the total. It's tuition plus room and board plus everything else that goes along with going to school. And it's just funny that we always talk about law school and the only thing that we're talking about is tuition. Like, I think it's just inherently misleading because everyone needs to consider the real cost, right? You're going to go to school and you're going to be paying tuition and you're going to be paying for living expenses. Is this something you want to, you have to, I don't know. It's just, I wish that we had those numbers more accessible.
I guess my pushback on that idea is that you're going to pay rent everywhere. And even if you compare the cheapest place in the world to the most expensive place in the world, the cost of living doesn't have to change that much. I mean, maybe it's 100% more to live in San Francisco than it is to live in Iowa. But I don't know. I think people should be living pretty frugally in law school anyway. And I kind of think that that stuff balances out, but what, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, so for example, right, like we're looking at different college options, and because room and board can account for a big, at more expensive schools, it doesn't, but at some schools it accounts for 50% of your cost, right? And then it's like, okay, well, you can go to that school or you could go to this other school and live with a family member who's close by.
Right.
And now
right.
all of a sudden we're saving $10,000, $12,000, sometimes $15,000 a year. Like, these things can make a big impact.
Yeah. And Nikki's talking about moving all over California, which makes me think that Nikki is probably a Californian, which makes me think that maybe Nikki does have housing options in California, you know, either in Northern California or Southern California. And it seems like, yeah, maybe you might want to prefer one of those schools where you can live at home if possible to save money.
Maybe. I guess when we talk about full tuition scholarships, people will kind of hear that and they think, wow, that's the win. I'm going for free. And it's like, no, just always remember there's this other expense and you have to account for that because you're probably not going to be working and you're going to have to cover that. So to me, full tuition is the bare minimum or at least very, very close to full, because you're still going to have thousands of dollars on top of that.
The other thing that Nikki is doing wrong in the email here is, and you'll see as we continue this email, maybe I'll read a little bit more.
Go for it. Sure.
So, we got, Hastings, $20,000 offer, but that it's like, I don't give a shit. I care how much they're not
covering.
You're
going to have to pay. Yeah. So what do I have to pay?
You're going to have to pay $24,000. Yep. Then she says, okay. Chapman full tuition plus $10,000 every year. So that's actually a negative $10,000 tuition. That's a real scholarship. That's like they're paying you to go there.
Yeah.
They're not going to charge you anything in tuition and they're going to write you a check for $10,000. Like, that's awesome. Okay. So there's a $34,000 annual difference there between Chapman and Hastings, even if just forgetting about housing for a second. That's a $10,000. That's a $34,000 difference per year. It's already $100,000 more expensive to go to Hastings, okay, than it is to go to Chapman.
Yeah.
So don't go to Hastings there.
Yep.
USD full tuition plus $2,000. That's University of San Diego. And that's, again, getting a bit of a stipend, a small stipend.
Yeah. It's still something, right? You're already up to full and then you're getting money on top of it.
Here's where Nikki fucks up again. Loyola $50,000. Parentheses would have to pay an extra $15,000. Well, okay, so it's going to cost you $15,000 to go to Loyola. That's the only thing. Like, the $50,000 is kind of fictional. I mean, it's not kind of fictional. It's extremely fictional. It's totally not real. They apparently have a nominal tuition of $65,000 a year at Loyola, which is a decidedly regional law school in Los Angeles. They're going to try to charge you $15,000 a year to go to Loyola. That's the number we care about. And Santa Clara, okay, zero. Full tuition, Santa Clara. Nikki continues, I would eventually like to end up doing public interest law, parentheses, specifically immigration and human rights law, but I would like to practice some sort of corporate law for my first couple years out of law school. I really loved UC Hastings when I went to visit, because of all the legal and judicial opportunities, as it is in downtown San Francisco.
I do not give a fuck. Look, I'm sorry to be so harsh on that.
Couldn't agree more. Go ahead.
I this is the problem, I think, with campus visits is it's like you fall in love with something that is not worth $100,000. So it's a totally irrational decision.
Yeah. I'll tell you what my experience was with the courts at when I went to UC Hastings. Yeah. We went on one field trip to the California Supreme Court to go watch them hear oral arguments.
Yeah.
And that was it. Otherwise, it was just lecture classes and that's it. There were, you know, like their proximity to the courts. I mean, yeah, okay. They probably have some connections. And yeah, if I was a better student or if I was more interested, I probably wouldn't have been able to get some connections to the courts there. But when I was at UC Hastings, the career office was specifically telling us that if we want to look for jobs, we needed to look for jobs outside of San Francisco. The admissions office says, look, we're right by the circuit court and we're right by the California Supreme Court and we're right by the district courts and City Hall. And they take you through Civic Center Plaza and you see all the glorious buildings and you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to be master of the fucking universe if I go to this school. Cause look at what it's just right in the middle of Civic
right
Center.
There. Yeah.
And then meanwhile, the career office is like, yeah, I need to talk to you about these jobs in Bakersfield because that's where you're going to actually probably be going if you want to get gainful employment. And it's just night and day. It's the admissions office says one thing and then the career office, which is much more realistic, says a completely different thing. So I would not consider that at all. I just don't. Your classes are going to be exactly the same no matter where you go to law school.
Yep, I agree.
Nikki asks, how much should I consider ranking? What do you think is my best option? What else should I consider? I would consider rebooting this entire, like none of these offers sound particularly great to me. I don't know what Nikki's LSAT was.
Yeah.
I know that Nikki did not take our advice about when to apply. Nikki applied in November, which is okay, but not what we normally recommend. I don't know if Nikki has the very best LSAT he or she could achieve.
Yeah.
And I do know that this was a pretty competitive cycle, it seems. None of those offers are terribly knocking my socks off. I mean, I guess I am happy about these full rides.
Yeah, I mean, for Chapman, USD, and Santa Clara, full tuition in two of those cases, plus additional money. I love that. All three of those schools do have conditional scholarships. So I'm looking at that right now in the 509s. So you have to be aware of that. I don't hate them. I think the fact you're getting money on top of full tuition makes it much more. Yeah, I mean, hey.
Yeah, I mean, like that Chapman deal seems like a pretty risk-free one-year experiment. You know, you go to Chapman for a year and you have this commitment to yourself that if you lose your scholarship, that means you're dropping out of law school.
Yeah, and USD is a much higher ranked school. It's still not like that much different than Chapman, but like if you're worried about ranking, it's 64. You still have full tuition plus 2K. I'm curious
same
too.
Thing. Drop out if you lose your scholarship.
Yeah, if you lose it, drop out. The reduction in scholarship rate is lower at USD
as so it tends to be when we go to higher ranked schools.
Yep. So, and I don't know if this is if I'm reading too much into this, but Nikki mentions housing for Hastings and mentions housing for Loyola, but does not mention housing for USD. Is there like, but.
Well, it's possible that, I mean, maybe Nikki is from San Diego.
Wow. Like, and that would be, yeah.
Although doesn't mention housing for Santa Clara either. So then that doesn't make any sense.
Mm, yeah.
Why would you have to pay for housing at Loyola? I mean, I guess maybe Nikki's worried because Loyola is downtown LA and Hastings is downtown San Francisco. And then maybe Nikki is less worried about other places, but like, it's not cheap to live in Santa Clara.
Yeah. No,
Santa Clara is like the most expensive place in the world
these days. Yeah. You got Facebook, Google, all that stuff right around there.
Atherton is right there. It's literally the most expensive place in the country. So
I'm
concerned. And I want to say one more thing, Nikki, that I'm really concerned about here.
Mm.
Where is University of San Francisco on this list? Where is Golden Gate University on this list? Those are both schools in San Francisco. Those are competitor schools to Hastings. I do not see them on the list. I see Santa Clara, but I don't see UC Davis, which is kind of the same distance in a slightly different direction and a cheaper place to live. They're a competitor of Hastings. Why aren't they on this list? In Los Angeles, where's Southwestern? Southwestern gives generous full ride scholarships left and right. Why are they not on your list?
Are those conditional? I'm curious.
Probably, yeah. But there are some options here, but it doesn't seem like why aren't there more options? If you're really looking like you're California focused, then I would expect to see all of the California regional schools. And I'm only seeing a few of them here, which makes me think that Nikki didn't maybe apply broadly enough to really find out what all her options are. Yeah. His or her, I should say, options. Okay.
Yep.
Hopefully that was useful. Let's do this email here from Anonymous.
Hi, Nathan. Hope you are well. I have tried blue booking with ChatGPT, and it is very dangerous because most of the time it confidently provides citations that look accurate, but when you double check them, they are not even close. Sometimes it generates proper citations. Lots of improvements to be made, Anonymous. Yeah, it's not where it's going to be, though. Even in a year, I imagine there are going to be branches of ChatGPT that are that are very proficient at whatever they claim to do.
And in five years, it's going to be night and day. I mean, it is going to improve very rapidly. And I agree with you 1,000%. Anytime you're doing any work with ChatGPT, you need to check it super carefully because it does look confident. If you want to bullshit someone in 30 seconds, use ChatGPT because it looks great. And then if you investigate frequently, it makes no sense beyond just a very shallow bit of research. But that is not going to always be the case. And when I saw this email, I was like, well, that you could probably still already get away with it in law school because like no one's going to take all the time to check these citations. So if it's like just some dumb citation homework or whatever, you could probably use ChatGPT on it and it would fly by, you know. But yeah, if you try to use that in an actual court case, then you're gonna end up potentially getting sanctioned, you know, for misrepresentations. I got another email from another student who was like, hey, I talked to my friend in big law and they have explicitly banned ChatGPT for all their matters, and as if that was, you know, dispositive in any kind of a way. And my response to that is like, well, yeah, no shit. I mean, right now I can definitely see the firms being like, hey, we don't know what this is. We can't trust this. We need let's put a moratorium on using ChatGPT, right? You know, all of you associates that we hired or whatever, nobody can use ChatGPT, but that does not mean that the legal industry is not seriously looking into this. I mean, at the very same time, right? I just imagine a big law firm being like, okay, policy, none of y'all use ChatGPT. And then they come over here to their like tech side and their real expert lawyers. And they're like, all right, guys, how do we get rid of 90% of our headcount by using ChatGPT?
exactly.
You know, none of you can use ChatGPT, by the way. Okay, now let's figure out how to actually use ChatGPT so that we can, have these enormous productivity gains that we are probably going to be able to get once we learn how to use this thing.
Well, the other thing too is there are some companies that have already done, quote, studies on what industries they will think are affected most by ChatGPT. And in every single case, the legal industry is mentioned either first or second. It's an industry that's prime for this kind of, efficiency, right?
Yep. Yep. Don't take when we are excited about ChatGPT, that doesn't mean that we think it's a finished product and we don't think
it's
that
not it's today. It's a year, 2 years.
Yeah.
Things are going to change.
But these artificial intelligences are going to be having an impact. By the time anybody listening to this graduates from law school, there are going to be, I would anticipate, profound changes, whatever those look like. But it's going to matter. You can't be a lawyer and not learn about ChatGPT.
Well, think about what's already happening, right? Like LexisNexis, these are forms of artificial intelligence. They're just not as maybe language proficient, but what they're doing is they're taking work off of attorney's shoulders, right? You're now not going to the library and looking Remember how you had to used to look at the book and then you'd have to look at the back of the book to see if there was a paper insert showing that the book had been updated since it had last been published? All that's gone.
I'd love to hear from a UC San Francisco / don't say Hastings law school student, because when I was a 1L at Hastings, it was already ridiculous that they made us do our legal research out of the goddamn law books.
Yeah.
Like, the law library also had computers that were equipped with LexisNexis and Westlaw. And as soon as we became 2Ls and we got anywhere near doing any kind of actual legal research, we were always doing it on the computer because, duh, no shit, you're going to be doing it on LexisNexis and Westlaw. That's what no lawyer is actually going and looking at law books. But I would wager that at Hastings, they're still dragging people on tours of their super fancy law library and talking about how they have all the journals and volumes and blah, 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 you know, and still probably
that no one uses,
haven't changed their 1L legal education. And they're still probably making people learn how to do it by going through the books and everything. Such a fucking waste of time. But no, you can't separate the technology from the legal practice. That's just, it's too powerful for this type of thing.
Yep.
Okay. One more email here from G. Why don't you go ahead and read it, Ben?
Sure. Hi, Ben and Nathan. First off, thank you for the podcasts, the demon, and the work you do. Last spring, I successfully appealed to earn an LSAC fee waiver, thanks in large part to advice on the podcast. Then, after using the demon, I scored a 171 on the August LSAT and a 179 in September. The demon is excellent, and your advice clearly pays off. However, the results of this cycle have confused me. I applied to 17 schools with a 179, or with the 179, and a 3.89 LSAC adjusted GPA. Some I applied to in September, others in October after September scores came out. Here's what I got. Full ride at Wake Forest, yet to be negotiated partial scholarships at Georgetown, Wash U in Texas, waitlisted at Columbia, Penn, Michigan, Chicago, Duke, UVA, and GW, rejected at Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Berkeley, no word from NYU or Boston. I wasn't expecting acceptances across the board, but I also wasn't expecting this much variation, especially given where I fall in schools' LSAT GPA percentiles. I'm trying to decide if these results reflect my, quote, market value, or if I should try again next cycle. Is this normal, or did I mess something up, like my personal statement or resume? I'm 33, but I wouldn't think that's a factor, right?
I emailed G for follow-up, and because I was also surprised with a 179 LSAT and a 3.89 LSAC GPA. 3.89 is probably below it's definitely below the medians, right? At Harvard, Yale, Stanford, that kind of school.
Sure.
But a straight rejection at all those schools and then wait lists at schools like, you know, other schools in the top 14, like Michigan, I'm Duke. Like I'm not expecting wait lists with 179s and 3.9s at those kinds of schools. And so I said, hey, let me see your personal statement and resume. Yeah. I read the personal statement. I scanned through the resume. I had Ben read through the personal statement. I had Ben read through the resume. We each independently arrived at the same conclusion about what it was that was holding G back. You want to talk about it a little bit?
Sure. So G, what was it? Your undergrad was a Christian university. Your work experience for the last couple of years was the manager at some Christian retreat center. And your personal statement was all about that. So when you're done looking at your resume and your personal statement, the brand that comes across is dedicated Christian, right? Loyal Christian. In theory, there's nothing wrong with that, but it was such a prominent component of your application. Oh, yeah. And I think this retreat center was in Waco, Texas. I don't know. There's a lot of
school was in Waco, Texas. Yeah, it was a Texas Christian preacher, dedicated, want to help people, but never really didn't, you know, there was nothing legal oriented at all on the resume. And the story that came across, and including the entire last paragraph of the personal statement, was essentially, I want to help people. Like, I want to work in law so that I can. And it was just kind of vague. Like, I want to be able to work in public interest in whatever way.
Yeah.
It just doesn't scream lawyer. You know, I mean, the majority of people who go to top 14 law schools, they do that because they're going to end up working in big law, and they're going to end up making a shit ton of money in big law. Like, big law is where money and prestige comes from in the legal profession. Yeah. And so when people want to work in public interest, but they don't have any like credible, actual legal ties on their resume. Yeah. I don't think it was your age, G, and it certainly wasn't your GPA or your LSAT that was holding you back, but your brand that was pictured in your personal statement and on your resume came off as well-meaning, doesn't know what he's getting himself into. And so the top 14s are just like, they, as Ben said, they have too many other applicants who also have 170 something LSATs and super high GPAs, but who have business ties and who have professional experience that's not just related to the church. And yeah, I think that what kept you out there, or kept you from getting the offers that you might have gotten with a different story, what was keeping you out was just like your elevator pitch. It just wasn't screaming like, here's somebody who knows what they're getting into when they're getting into big time law. Be LSAT famous. Ask us questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, you should email our best in the world customer service team. That's help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 397 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.